The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. I know our crowd would love the Book Nook Reading Valet. It's a wood holder for your book, your mug, your reading glasses, e-reader, and or a phone, so you can carry it from your room to your bedside to the bathtub. It has a 4.9 out of 5 rating on over 178 reviews. I also thought you guys would like, all of you pet lovers out there, would like the custom pet embroidered sweatshirt, so you can have a custom portrait of your animal on your sweater and have them with you all day. Uncommon Goods has something for everybody, from moms and dads to kids and teens, book lovers, sports fans and foodies, gardeners, crafters, readers and writers. You will find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes, because you can make your money go farther this holiday season, because with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. That is incredible stuff. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/tsnotya. That's uncommongoods.com/TSNOTYAW for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer, Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, then chances are you've heard me talk about the importance of writing on a line level. And of course I have. Because while movies get to rely on lighting, soundtrack, acting, and special effects, books rely only on words to make a story come to life, which is why the writing matters so much. My question to you is, are you confident about your writing? Do you feel like it's at the level it needs to be to stand out in the competitive publishing landscape? If you're like most writers I know, then you're always looking for ways to improve. Well, what if I told you that there's a way to supercharge your learning experience by hacking writing on a line level? That's right, hacking it. I've developed an original 4-day course, Hacking Writing on a Line Level, that will show you specific techniques to elevate your writing on a word level, sentence level, paragraph level, and scene level. This course begins on December 4th. My favorite part about it is that there are clear, specific examples in every single slide. No fluff, all actionable content. And for the first time ever, we'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. I'm super excited about this new format because I've seen it yield results in writers' works. And it works for writers of any genre, as long as you're serious about improving your writing on a line level and as long as you're a reader. So if you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for this 4-day course. It's a fan favorite. Don't worry if you can't attend live, the sessions will be recorded. For more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another Books with Hooks segment. As per usual, we are going to dive straight in. Carly, can you please read us your query letter?
Dear Carly, I'm seeking representation for my YA fantasy novel, The Last Tree in Galanthus, complete at 75,000 words. It is the first in a planned trilogy with a sequel already in progress. 17 years ago, humans overthrew the Elven monarchy and declared the dawn of a new age, an equal democratic society powered by technology instead of magic. But equality was a lie. Now Galanthus is dying. Elves are imprisoned in compounds, their ears clipped and mutilated. Orcs waste away in refugee camps. Dwarves hide in underground ruins. And both humans and otherworldlies face starvation as resources vanish. Hope rests on three unlikely allies: the heir to the elven throne, an exiled princess raised by humans, her fiercely loyal human sister, and the disillusioned son of the president who led the revolution. The princess harbors a secret, growing power, the ability to restore life to a dying world. Together, the three must heal the fractures their parents left behind, but deception, forbidden love, and the legacy of old betrayals threaten to unravel their fragile alliance before it can begin. The Lastrian Galanthus blends the elemental magic of An Ember in the Ashes with the political complexity of Red Queen. It will appeal to fans of Tomi Adeyemi's The Children of Blood and Bone and Tracy Dion's Legendborn. With its focus on political intrigue, rebellion, and sisterhood, it reimagines familiar fantasy tropes, placing elves and orcs not as all-powerful beings, but as marginalized survivors in a modern society. I grew up in South Africa, where I witnessed both the deep scars of segregation and the beauty of people uniting across divides. Those experiences shaped the heart of the story. This isn't a book with an agenda, but one that invites young readers into a richly imagined world. It explores the complexities of siblings and friendship bonds, encourages reflection on the shape of society, and captures the thrill of romance just beginning to unfold. I would be honored by your consideration and would be delighted to share the full manuscript at your request. Sincerely, Redacted.
Thank you so much, Carly. Okay, what was that word count and what was your take on it?
Yeah, so it came in at around 350 words. So my take on it, let's just start at the top. So I really like this title. I think it's great. I think the word count is pretty much on point here. You say the first in a planned trilogy with a sequel already in progress. That's great. I just wouldn't put that there. I would put the comps there and then I would take that line and put it at the bottom because, you know, I always talk about real estate, you know, query letter is real estate, and the most valuable real estate is going to be at the top, which catches people's attention. And for a YA fantasy novel, many people will assume that it could be a series. So I think that goes without saying, but it doesn't have to take up valuable real estate at the top. So I put the comps here, focus on the hook a bit more. What I think this query letter does really well, and it's very hard to do well, is just really like simplify the world. I think we have a very strong understanding of what's actually happening in this world in terms of, you know, the good guys, the bad guys, the complexities, the magic, all of that sort of stuff. So I think that's really well done. What I think this query fails to do is really center a main character, because they're short kind of paragraphs, if you want to call them that, but essentially like three paragraphs talking about the world, and we don't have a main character to kind of introduce as the lens in which we're going to see this through. Starting with the facts, and again, it's balance of like, I think it does this well, but if we could center a main character, I think it'd be even stronger, because it comes off as you are just describing a world, and what we want to do is follow a character through the world and see the world through this character's eyes. So that's what I think will really make this a lot stronger. The other thing is we never name anybody. It's an exiled princess, a fiercely loyal human sister, a disillusioned son of the president. By not naming them, it also kind of creates a lot of distance between the reader and what's happening here. So I think naming them would help as well, kind of bring this story to life. Overall, there is something familiar about this, right? It's like there's a revolution and there are two sides and there's allies. So I'm always trying to figure out with a story like this, what is the thing that is going to really, you know, make it stand out. I think you bury the love story here, and I can't quite figure out why we're burying the love story. If perhaps because this is a planned trilogy, the love story doesn't really blossom until later in the trilogy, perhaps. But I think if we can kind of explain that a little bit more, I think that would create a little bit more stakes between these two sides and how these allies come together. I think that would help a lot. And yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of those things where it's not my primary category, so it's hard for me to say whether I think this will or won't stand out in this category. But I do think you've done a great job of summarizing the world. As long as you can center a main character, I think that will really make this one stand out even more and kind of help illuminate what is unique and special about this when somebody does read a lot of fantasy queries.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, we're handing it across to you now.
I thought it was really imaginative. Like, I always think it's so impressive that someone can come up with such a unique and, you know, imaginative world. So definitely echoing what Carly said about the world building is really clear. You did a really good job of conveying that. But, and again, this is where I feel mean, it feels too big picture. Like, it feels too zoomed out. You know, I'm not looking at the story. I'm like a bird flying in the sky, looking down at planet Earth, as opposed to being inside planet Earth in a specific city, in a specific neighborhood, in a specific house. I'll give you examples. So the princess has a power and, reading from the query letter, the ability to restore life to a dying world. What does that mean? That's too big of a power, right? So if she has the ability to restore life, just do it. But then I'm thinking, okay, so she can't use her power for some reason. Like her power, you know, in order to be activated, they need to go on a quest. Great. What does that quest look like? I have no idea because you haven't told me. You've told me that they must heal the fractures their parents left behind. Don't know what that looks like. You've told me that deception, forbidden love, and the legacy of old betrayals are threats. I don't know what the quest looks like. In fantasy, it's really easy to get bogged down by world building. And I empathize so much. But the quest is where we need specificity. Like the quest is the most important part, you know? You are spending a lot of time, and you're doing it really well, by the way, focusing on the backstory, the history, focusing on the themes, the heart. You know, there's a beautiful line here about it explores the complexity of sibling and friendship bonds, encourages reflection. That's actually really great that you know that about your story. It shows that your story has layers and layers, and that's impressive, but you can't lead with that. Because at the end of the day, in order for someone to fall in love with your story's themes and for your story to stay with someone and for an acquiring editor to be like, oh, this book really stayed with me and made me think of, you know, my sibling and my friendship and those bonds first, they need to be really curious about the story. And you haven't given us enough on the story. So I think you really need to rethink, to Carly's point about real estate, what are you going to lead with? Lead with that quest. Really focus on that quest and make it super specific.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, can you tell us what's in the opening pages?
All right, we start with a prologue called The Pale Palace. We are opening in the morning. There is some sort of kind of war, revolution of some kind happening in the distance. We imagine that we are in the palace and the threat of this war, whatever's happening, is getting closer and closer to them. We know that there is obviously a lot going on between like the monarch and we have a character named Rain, and they are speaking in Elfish, an old language that they have spoken. And then they go down the hall. Once they kind of work through some of the war stuff, they go down the hall and somebody is giving birth to a elfin baby, which seems like a very like rare occasion and everybody's really excited about it. But the war is kind of coming closer to them and they decide that they have to take the baby and get the baby to safety because of the, again, battle coming towards the palace. They decide that the baby is going to be raised by humans. There's a bit of a disagreement between the characters about whether that's the right thing to do. And one of the, I think we can assume, I'm pretty sure, human servants is going to take the baby across a border to be raised by a human family. And that is where the prologue ends. And then we jump to 17 years later. We have a chapter one. We're in the POV of somebody called Violet. And we know that essentially this is the sister of the baby who was being raised in this human family. And this is an interaction in this chapter between the two sisters. And that is where we are.
Awesome, Carly. Okay, so what did you think?
All right. So I really loved the first paragraph. I thought it was so well done. I'll read it because I think it was really, really great. We are in the eye of the storm, Rain thought. He could just make out the smoke billowing up from the horizon, a hangover from the attack on the orcs the night before. It was almost peaceful now. The wind had dropped and the thickness of the night sky was melting away, making way for the dark bruise of dawn. Brilliant writing. You know, you can obviously tell this person spent so much time crafting this opening piece and has such a way with words. So I thought that was so, so well done. The next paragraph is where I started to kind of wander my mind away. Like I really wanted to be swept into this world. I was like, okay, there's a battle and there's orcs and there's elves and, you know, and I was in it. And I'm like, okay, the dawn is rising. And then the next line, he says, how long do we have? Argo was talking to someone on his cell phone inside the palace. And as soon as I heard the word cell phone, my brain goes, okay, technology, what's different about this world? How is this world different than ours? And I start to just like spin and spiral and like create my own narrative and questions about the world. And if you don't kind of, it's not that you always have to immediately answer the questions that the reader has, but you don't want the reader to start to have their mind wander. So as I was kind of reading these pages, I was looking for instances where I was kind of pulled out of the narrative. And essentially this draft reads to me as something that definitely still needs to go through you know, editing in terms of like beta readers, and there's still a lot of work to do. I can tell this person understands their world so deeply, which is incredible. But there's instances where, you know, just interactions between these elves. So we're trying to figure out like, okay, who's the monarch and what is he doing? And one scene, the monarch's upset after he throws this cell phone, and then it says, "There must be more we can do." Rain knelt before his king, placing both his hands on his monarch's slumped head. But you never tell us where the monarch is. Is he on a couch? Is he on the ground? Is he in a chair? I just found the stage directions really out of sync. And I felt like I was doing all the mental gymnastics as the reader to fill in the gaps of what was actually happening in the story from a scene point of view. I just felt like the Graspon scene wasn't as strong as it could be, because the Graspon world is very strong. The Graspon scene, I thought, needs some more work. So I was definitely like pulled out a number of times. I think this is really interesting because Rain, this character Rain, again, I didn't understand who they were in particular. I didn't know if they were like a son, a stepson, a general. I did not understand who Rain was, but Rain did not like the humans. And I really liked when we got a little bit of friction between he didn't trust them and why doesn't he trust them? That was really, really well done. But I also didn't know if Rain was an orc or an elf. I'm assuming Rain was an elf because they were in the elf, you know, castle. Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't understand like their relationship to how they felt about everything. I also didn't understand how old Rain was. And if we're centering somebody named Rain, clearly they're very important in this story, but was Rain just a figure to get us to the scene where the baby is born, who is the princess who will have all the powers? So I didn't really understand who I'm supposed to be focusing on in particular. And because we had such an emphasis on our character named Rain, I just assume they're going to have a lot more to do with it, which is why I want a lot more internal reaction to how he felt about everything. Because at one point they said, Argo looked up, he looked his years, he had not slept for days. None of them had. And I kind of made a note, maybe this is an opportunity to kind of establish something, right? Like Rain hadn't seen him this tired since the rebellion 5 years ago, and then da 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 da, right? We get into some contextualization of this relationship, because I think a prologue that leaves too many questions is a failed prologue, because the goal of prologue is obviously to establish some excitement or energy or what's to come, or tease something a little bit. But when we're teasing everything, then how is a prologue doing justice to the story that it's trying to tell? So that was the part where I was just lost about how this was in service to the larger story, because it is a lot of premise. And obviously the reason that we're focusing on this is obviously because the baby is being born. And obviously that's very important because she is our princess. Another reason that I think this is still like nascent stages of a draft is when there's dialogue happening, there's a lot of repeating the character's name in the dialogue, which it is just one of my pet peeves. So maybe it was standing out to me, but it would say, you know, how is she, May? Argo asked. She is battling my king. She's in lots of pain, but it should be over soon. Argo opened the door and gestured for May to step aside. Wait here, Rain, he said. I will call you in. Just a lot of that. Like we know everybody that's in the scenes. We don't always have to say who's in the scene or address them. Again, if there's the formality with the king piece, that makes sense to me. But addressing everybody by their name while we have the dialogue tag and we understand who's all in the scene is one of my pet peeves. But that could just be me. Okay, so then we jump to chapter one. This person sent us a very long sample. I will give them not a slap on the wrist, but they did send us like 7 pages. But I think it was because they wanted the prologue and then they wanted to give us the chapter one. So I understand why they did that, but it is longer than the 5 pages. So when we jump to chapter one, Crossing the Border, we are with Violet and Arena. And Arena is the princess baby character that is supposedly born in the prologue. And it says 17 years later, but these pages felt very young to me, which actually worried me a little bit, because like they're talking about like, hurry up, we're late, come look at this. And then she says, if it's another ant carrying food, I'm going to be mad. That felt very young to me. What is it that she wants her to look at? Like ants and bugs felt like so young and juvenile to me. So I worried a little bit with this being a YA novel, that felt like a very young scene to me. So I just want to flag that, just kind of making sure that we are at the YA level here with these characters and where they are. But I will stop there and I will turn it over to you guys.
Thanks, Carly. Okay, Cece.
I just want to say it's not a pet peeve, Carly. I'm going to diagnose you. It's your agent brain going, this is still green. Because when you repeat names in dialogue often, that is 100% my dialogue is still being workshopped. That's something I recommend most writers do. Like, take your dialogue and actually cut as much as possible. Sometimes you can even cut every other line, which is a screenwriting technique. But again, we talk about names. It is one of those things where you can tell, this is still green.
Can I just interject there?
Yes,
I want to say that in the last year, I've read like 3 novels by well-established authors who are extremely well-known, and they do it too. And then I'm like, this is not a green author. Yes. They should know better, and the editor should have done something. So it is a pet peeve of mine.
100%. And that's fair. I think I also think a lot of authors go, but hey, I'm reading these novels. They're doing it. Why can't I? You're held to a higher standard. That's why. This is the reality of publishing, people. I feel very strongly, I've said this before, this is a hill I will die on. Never begin your book, never, with direct thoughts in italic. Never. There is no reason to. Seriously, we're already inside the protagonist's head. There's no reason for you to do the direct thoughts in italics. Just have it be, rain was in the eye of the storm, or they were in the eye of the storm, period. Like, you don't need the direct thoughts. It's completely unnecessary. It is not something that is wrong. This is a CC problem. I'm just letting you know. We are in Rain's head for the prologue. I don't think Rain is a main character, though. Just based on the query letter, I don't think Rain is. I think Rain was the POV the author chose because they wanted the book to begin with the baby being born and the mother, which was very heartbreaking, having to give the baby up, right, to be raised by humans. So I think the author was like, I'm going to choose Rain's point of view to do that, which is fair. If they had started with the mother, then we would have all been like totally broken because the woman was giving birth and having to give up her baby, and it would have been the most depressing thing I've ever read. If they had started with the king, maybe the king has too much power. So like, I get it. I get why you chose Rain. At the same time, like, I don't know if there isn't another option. If there isn't an option of like an omniscient bird's eye prologue, or if you're going to go inside Rain's head just for the prologue, then really go inside Rain's head. Because right now, and Carly mentioned this, the king tells Rain it's done, which is the most tragic thing they can hear in that moment. And there's no emotional reaction from Rain, no interiority. Rain speaks and he moves, but he has no internal reaction. And we're reading a book. I'm supposed to feel someone's internal reaction. And then the king, who by the way is teasing Rain apparently, the king's like, no, but there is hope. Okay, well now Rain's heart is supposed to soar because there's hope. Or maybe he has a relationship with hope that's like, no, he won't let himself hope. You know, because hope has led to too much heartbreak in his life. I don't know. But the point is, there's a pinball effect in storytelling, which is when you have a character say something to another character, there needs to be a reaction from your protagonist, from the person whose head you're in. And when your protagonist says something, they need to be interpreting the other character's reaction, their face, their eyes, their body movements. They need to be imagining what they're thinking. And that pinball effect is what makes a book a book. And it's so important that as the author, you really, really direct us with a lot of intentionality in a tight, precise, very curiosity-inducing way. It's a hard thing to do, but it's something you have to do. So I was like, again, maybe we have to be in this person's head, but if we are, then you really need to go in. I will say this, the idea of a book where the main character, I'm assuming she's the main character, is an elf that was raised by humans, that I love. Like that I think is super original, super fun. It's like outsider-y. It opens up a whole bunch of possibilities for power imbalances, for, you know, messy dynamics. That's brilliant. But your chapter one, and Grinch hat, should I get my Grinch hat? Your chapter one, it's just not as curiosity-inducing as it needs to be, you know? Like it's these two girls just being. And I know there's a lot of advice out there that says chapter one should be a snapshot of your protagonist's life before the inciting incident, the status quo, so the inciting incident can disrupt. But that status quo still needs to be interesting and curiosity-inducing. It can't just be another day, like a random day. I've had a lot of writers tell me, but hey, Cece, in this book, isn't it another day? And I go and I read the book and I'm like, no, it's not just another day. This is why it's a really curiosity-inducing moment in the story. And I think that advice leads to a lot of bad beginnings, wrong beginnings, maybe. I think that's what's happening here. I don't know. I would love to ask this author, who is your protagonist? Like, is it the princess? I think it is, but I don't know. So it's something to think about, but I definitely think you have an interesting hook. It's just still in the early draft stage, in my view.
Thank you so much, Cece. Okay, before we move to the next query, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, everybody. Guess who's back from France? I was thinking of you guys, listening to me talk about getting ready for the trip and practicing my French while I was doing my best to order en français at the cafes. It went well. I was a bit nervous, but when we were in the countryside and I could take my time thinking about what I wanted to say, I was able to say it. Being a bilingual family is high on my list of things that are super important to me as a parent and a mom. If we're going to show them the world, we also need to appreciate and respect the language and culture by learning it. Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local languages when you travel. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn faster and retain longer. There's no English translations. You truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so it sticks with you. You can work on your accent with the built-in True Accent speech recognition technology, so it'll help you sound more natural. You can learn anytime, anywhere. It fits with your lifestyle with a flexible on-the-go learning style, desktop or mobile app. And there's incredible value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. As the air turns crisp and the holidays draw near, comfort becomes the best gift of all. Quince delivers layers that last, sweaters, outerwear, and everyday essentials that feel luxurious, look timeless, and make holiday dressing and gifting effortless. By working directly with ethical, top-tier factories, Quince skips the middlemen and offers prices 50% less than similar brands. That's how you get amazing deals like the ones that I am obsessed with. Honestly, the Italian wool coats are at the top of my list. The cuts feel designer, the quality rivals high-end brands, but without the high-end markup. Quince truly has it all. $50 Mongolian cashmere sweaters made for everyday wear. Denim that never goes out of style. Silk tops and skirts that add polish. And down outerwear built to take on the season. Perfect for gifting or upgrading your own wardrobe. If you guys watch my reels on Instagram and you see me in a soft gray sweater tee, that is my favorite Quince piece. And now I have it in two colors. All of my Mongolian cashmere items are staples in my wardrobe. I have the cashmere sweater tee in gray. That's the one you see on Instagram. And the Mongolian cashmere mock neck sweater vest in oatmeal. There's something so classy about a sleeveless sweater look, and it doesn't bunch up in a coat. So seamless and classy and so warm. At these price points, I am happy to wear them to the hockey rink and to go out for dinner with friends. The timelessness of them makes them so functional. So if you want to be effortlessly warm and chic, I recommend those picks. Quince also has things for everyone on your list. I've shopped for my boys as well. There are great kids basics to be found. Step into the holiday season with layers made to feel good, look polished, and last from Quince. Perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Go to quince.com/tsnotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That is quince.com/tsnotya to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tsnotya.
All right. Now we're handing it across to Cece. Could you read us your query?
Dear Ms. Lyra, I'm seeking representation for Crooked Soldiers, a 74,000-word narrative nonfiction memoir set inside New York's notorious MCC jail, dubbed the Guantanamo of the East. Think Orange is the New Black meets Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, where kung fu, insider trading, and mafia ghosts collide in a love story told through daily prison letters. This book took 22 years to finish because Mike, the story's central figure and my soulmate, died before I could complete it. Years after his passing, his letters still wrecked me. Wholesale grief, unsolicited bawling. Eventually, that grief became fuel. I was on a mission, like training for an Ironman, to tell the stories only Homie and I knew. Cricket Soldier centers on two unlikely cellmates, Mike, a mantis kung fu master and grandson of an Italian mobster, and Bunky, son of a Dominican drug dealer. Inside MCC's absurd, terrifying, and surreal system, a rotating meta-puzzle of codes, Chinatown spice runs, and cryptic jailhouse hierarchies, Mike holds onto his sanity through his off-kilter bond with Mudge, his kung fu partner and wife. When Mike is imprisoned for insider trading, Mudge challenges him to write every day, so his time inside won't be wasted. The result is a story of incarceration, devotion, and survival spanning three generations of Italian and Dominican families, from Sicily and La Vega to Queens and the Bronx. I'm an inventor, movement junkie, and compulsive creator of things, from martial arts, theater, and kinetic gaming wearables to this book. I was a member of the U.S. Wushu team, the first female disciple of Tong Bei Kung Fu, and toured 22 countries with my Belgian dance company, C13. I've worked as a designer and animator for NASA, MTV, and NBA, and in 2022 published Walk, a satirical travelogue about walking 1,000 kilometers after total hip replacement surgery. I speak 7 languages and share my book with over 30,000 followers across Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. I am also Mudge in this book. The full manuscript is available upon request and is currently under review with another agent. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Cece. Wow, that's one of the most interesting author bios I've read in a very, very long time. Can you tell us what the word count of that was and then your take on it?
The word count was 352. My take from the top. Narrative, nonfiction, memoir. Is it a memoir? Then all you need to do is write memoir. If it's narrative nonfiction, all you need to do is write narrative nonfiction. You're essentially telling me it's two different genres. Like, there's just no need for it. Maybe you're thinking, but my memoir is told in narrative nonfiction. Anyone wondering, narrative nonfiction, people describe it as a genre of storytelling that will present the facts that come with nonfiction, but, you know, through the techniques of storytelling. But we don't have to specify that. Like, a memoir is already told in usually narrative creative form. I don't know that this is a memoir, though, and I'll get to that in a second. Paragraph 2. It is a paragraph about how this book took 22 years to finish because the author, the person who was querying us, the person who is being brave and vulnerable and so courageous right now, went through horrible, horrible grief. Please know, human, that I feel for you so much. You do not want to write this in your query letter, though. I know I sound horribly mean, but here's the deal. Agents review thousands of query letters every month, and we read a lot of query letters that start with, I wrote this book to save my life because when I was growing up, I didn't have a book like this. I wrote this book because I was dealing with the grief after my mother died and it was heartbreaking. I wrote this book because my grandmother shared this cookie recipe with me and I miss my grandmother every day. What you are telling me inadvertently is you wrote this because you were processing your grief. If your book ever makes it, this is actually a really cool story to share in an author interview. But you never want to lead with that. You don't want to lead with that because you don't want to make me, the agent, the business person, the person who's seeking a financial investment in your product, to think that this isn't actually a product. You don't want me to think that this is a diary that you are now querying. That is what this paragraph makes it seem. I, again, know this sounds harsh, but you are not positioning yourself for success by focusing on that origin story, especially at the top of your query letter. After an agent has fallen in love with your pages, yes, share all these origin stories, but don't lead with it. I know that a lot of people go, but when I tell my writing group about it, they think it's so cool that I spent 22 years. Your writing group is not reviewing thousands of submissions a month. It's just the reality of life, okay? So set yourself up for success, focus on your story, focus on how the reader is going to have an awesome experience reading it, not your experience writing it. Now, when it comes to the plot paragraph, and this is why I'm not sure this is a memoir, there are two stories here. There's a love story between the protagonist, who's the author, well, I don't know if she's the protagonist. There's the love story between Mudge and Mike. And then there's the unlikely cellmate story between Mike and Bunky. It feels like two different books. Like, if you are writing the story of Bunky and Mike, based on the letters that Mike sent you, that is narrative nonfiction, right? If you are writing a memoir about how your husband went to prison, then maybe that is a memoir. I guess I just don't, I don't see how it could be two things. It feels like you're trying to accomplish a lot with this book. It almost looks like two books in one. I wanted to know, is this the story of Mike and Bunky, or is this the story of Mudge and Mike? And I'm not saying that Bunky can't play a supporting role in the story of Mike and Mudge. Of course he can. But we need to center on a big relationship. I also think that, again, the author paragraph, I agree with B, like, is the most impressive, creative one we've ever seen. You also don't have to get into that much detail. I love that you went on all these amazing quests, but I would pick like two things that you think are most impressive that mean the most to you and lead with that. And then maybe have like a longer author bio on your website or something, just because I think you need to develop the plot paragraph and you are going to need more words to do that. So it is not because it's not impressive, because it's super fun. And touring 22 countries with your Belgian dance company, like, come on, that's so cool, right? I just don't think that we need all these details about your life at this point, especially when the memoir doesn't seem to be tied to any of these things, right? Like, I think that's a really important point. If you were writing a memoir about being a dancer, then absolutely, that would make total sense. But that's not what the memoir is about. The memoir is about your husband going to prison. When a story is once removed, like, my husband went to prison, these are his letters to me, it's really important to find a way to still center it on yourself if you are a protagonist, if you are the memoirist, or you're writing narrative nonfiction. You're just writing a different kind of book. So I wish the author were here so I could ask her a whole bunch of questions and also say, like, you've clearly led a very full life, which is awesome.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, we're handing it across to Carly now.
I'm going to start with the author paragraph and work backwards, because that was kind of a good point that Cece ended on. One thing I want to add to what Cece said was, I completely agree. This is an incredibly impressive author bio, and this person has lived so many lives in one life. One of the main purposes of an author bio also is to establish yourself as an author and as an authority. And when you say, I've done all of these things, to some, it might look like you are not an author, or you're not trying to establish yourself as an author because you do all of these things, and could potentially look scattered and not focused, because how do I, as the person reading this, know that your next journey is going to be an author, or you're really committing to your craft? To me, when you list all of these things, it's like, well, how do I know that they're going to focus on the book and not jump back into touring with their Belgian dance company, or, you know, going back to work for NASA, when I hope that their goal is going to be focusing on this book. So that's just one way to read a very busy author bio. So if you're going to edit this, or if I was going to suggest how to edit this, I would probably be focusing on working as a designer and animator for NASA, MTV, and NBA, and their published piece, Walk, and the seven languages. I would focus on that. I would keep that and your work on social media. The part that you could probably cut would be the Wushu team, the disciple, and the Belgian dance company probably could go, just because some of this obviously has something to do with the themes in the actual story, which is great, but doesn't actually have as much to do about centering you as a writer in this new era of your career and your life. So again, that's just one way to read that. Okay, coming back up to the top here, comps. Orange is the New Black and Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Obviously two iconic mentions here. They are also old mentions, so I really would encourage you to find some more recent comps. These are good comps, but again, they're a bit older. So what I always say is, if you want to go with older comps, one could be older, but the other one has to be newer. You can't go with two older comps, or else you're just dating yourself, right? Because it's like, we want to show how it's relevant to this market right now. All right, now the hook here. I agree with Cece, like everything Cece said, so I'm probably just going to be doubling down on some of the things she said, but I don't really know what is the central story here. And more importantly, what is the reader going to get out of this? Because, again, writing a book for yourself and working through your grief, as Cece kind of explained, is a wonderful thing. But when you're creating a product to go out into the world to service readers, to ask them to spend $30 how is the reader going to be transformed and entertained through this? And when the hook says, we're at Kung Fu, insider trading and mafia ghosts collide in a love story told through daily prison letters, like collide how, transform the reader how? I just don't think this thought or this hook is finished in its entirety, because there has to be a reason that the reader kind of goes into this book expecting one thing and then they come out the other side transformed, whether it's transformed about, you know, learning more about the prison system or how true love prevails or, you know, certain upbringings don't set people up for certain successes and how all that kind of comes into being throughout somebody's life. I think there's just so many great things that the reader can be taught and learn potentially through the story. Again, I haven't read much of it. There's just no promise here of what's to come. And I think that's what I'm struggling with, because all of this stuff on this page is interesting. I still don't understand how any of this is connected to a central story. I think this is a great narrative nonfiction, and we'll get to the pages in a little bit. I don't think this is a memoir. I think this is more of a narrative nonfiction because, again, as Cece said, it is kind of removed. It isn't this person telling their story. It's them telling the story of somebody else. But if they're going to be the main character and it is a bit removed, the narrative nonfiction or the memoir plus or however you kind of want to frame it gives the author an opportunity to do some research and, you know, educate the reader and go on these little kind of rabbit holes of how we can explore some of these themes and these topics without having to box themselves into a memoir, which, you know, has so many, you know, expectations. I think this person wants to explore a lot of themes based on, again, everything that I've read in this sample. And I think the narrative nonfiction is going to be the way that we're going to get there. Yeah, there's just a lot of listing of things. I really want to know how this all comes together. To me, the entry point of the story is, so this person says, the result is a story of incarceration, devotion, and survival spanning three generations of Italian and Dominican families from Sicily and La Vega to Queens and the Bronx. I think that's the entry point into the story, which to me, again, suggests there's going to be research. There's going to be stories that need to be told as offshoots of the central narrative. But I think you also have to spell it out. Like, is it going to be told through letters, or is what you are going to be doing inspired by the letters and you bring it to life in this larger narrative way? That's where I think this person would have the most success in trying to bring this story in this way to life.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, can you please summarize the pages for us and then tell us what you thought of them?
Okay, so page one is actually a synopsis. And I will tell every writer out there that if you ever send me a synopsis, I will immediately close my laptop and cover my eyes and duck and be very dramatic, because I do not like synopses. Like, I don't want spoilers. And so, yeah, there's a one-page synopsis. I did not read it. I refuse. And then we have the five pages. So it starts with chapter one, which is, it's not being called a bird's eye prologue, but it is very clearly a bird's eye prologue. That's just about how if a person is cremated, like how cremation works, you know, the heat of cremation and the fact that this is a man that weighs a certain amount and how heavy his ashes are. And when he's cremated, all evidence of wrongdoing also burns away, which meant that he did nothing wrong. And then it goes to, it's not called chapter one, but it feels like chapter one, which is a letter from Mike to Mudge talking about how there was a shakedown at 5:30 a.m. in the prison where people were confiscating contraband. It doesn't really seem to be specific to him. He was just sharing what was happening in general. And he's saying that he learned some trade secrets, but that he can't share. Then we go to, again, it's not called a chapter, but it's like a different section called Two Faces and Four Arms, 1966. And we see two babies be born, baby A and baby B. And, you know, it's clear that it's Mike and Mudge. So, you know, baby A being the boy, baby B being the girl, and how they are going to meet one day, you know, and how they're the same height and they get to exchange clothes. And, you know, it ends with a quote from a poet, love knows not its own depth until the hour of separation, and foreshadows, you know, which was also to come. Okay, thoughts on this execution. I will be super honest here. I don't think this is a story for me. It is very experimental. Very, very, very experimental. And when something is that experimental, I've learned that I'm not the right agent for it. So You know, you still queried the podcast, you chose to address it to me, so I will of course share my notes with you. But I do want to preface all my comments by saying you are very welcome to just ignore everything I am saying, because if your story is experimental and I don't love experimental, then do you really want my opinion? I think that you need to rewrite this entirely. I think you need a narrative structure. I think you need to decide what kind of story this is, whether it's a memoir, whether it's narrative nonfiction, whatever it is. And I think you need a clear, clear structure. I think you need to go and study the craft of storytelling. I see a lot of beginner mistakes here. Beginner mistake number one, just including a letter, not including potentially the best letter or the most curiosity-inducing letter, or a letter that sets you up for success as, you know, the first page. I think you're being very lofty is the word, I think, in your writing. You know, you're talking about like being born. A lot of memoirists, beginner memoirists, I should say, do this. They go, this is my memoir. I'm going to start with being born. No, very few memoirs should begin with being born. Very few successful memoirs begin with being born. There's no focus, you know, like the first chapter is focused on cremation. And then the second chapter is focused on the letter and how it's about the shakedown and people, you know, are trying to get rid of their contraband. And then the next chapter is about the two people being born. So one chapter is not building on the other. You know, a really compelling story, you have, whether it's a prologue or chapter one, something happening, a disruption, perhaps not the inciting incident, but maybe that makes us go, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And then chapter two builds on that. And that is true even when chapter two shares backstory. Because the backstory, if it's chosen to go in chapter two, is still building on what happened, either offering contrast or curiosity or some type of tension. And here, I don't know what I'm reading, if I'm being super honest. I am reading three different books, three different beginnings, three different middles of a book, actually. They don't even feel like beginnings. And I think this writer, remember when I said when I was analyzing the query letter that sometimes writers could unintentionally give off the idea of, I wrote this for therapy. And as you know, people who are at the end of the day trying to sell a product, that's not a good look. The pages are reading like that. The pages are reading like you're figuring out your emotions, your grief. And, you know, I think that a lot of people, your friends, your therapist, your loved ones would go, that's amazing. It's amazing that in order to process these big emotions, you're putting pen to paper and letting it all out. But I don't think that it's translating into a sellable project, which is super harsh. I know. I would just rewrite this. If you want my notes is start from the beginning. Figure out what your story is and write it like a novel. You're going to say, it's not a novel. A good memoir reads like a novel. If this is a memoir, it should read like a novel. And if this is narrative nonfiction, it should still rely on those nuts and bolts of storytelling that take the reader on a journey that feels very tight and very intentional. You still need all those elements. You need a protagonist. You need a disruption. You need an inciting incident. You need surprise. You need active emotions. Like you still need all that, regardless of what genre you choose. So that's my take.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly?
I agree with everything Cece said. You know, I definitely think it needs to be rewritten because we just don't have a narrative arc that we're kind of building on. You know, one memoir that I recommend to everybody from like an incredible storytelling point of view is Inheritance by Dani Shapiro. It's a really, really great memoir if you're trying to explore some things and figure out where the secrets should come in and how do you reveal to the reader what the protagonist already knows, but do it in a narrative way that feels honest to the genre of memoir while still surprising and delighting the reader in an entertaining way. So that there's something to learn. So that there's something to turn the pages for. So I highly recommend Inheritance by Dani Shapiro as something that you can use as potential building blocks to think about. Because to me, there just is no sign of a protagonist. The Wikipedia entry cremation piece was, again, interesting, but felt experimental. I did like, I think my favorite thing of all of this in terms of the sample writing was after the kind of explanation of the cremation piece, as Cece mentioned in her summary, they said, you know, all, burned away was all the evidence of wrongdoing. And the last line in that section says, that meant nobody did nothing wrong. And I just love that because I just wanted to go deeper on that. You know, what is our perception of right and wrong? How does this author feel about what their partner did? I don't know. To me, that was just like, why did we end there? It felt like this was aspiring to be an essay collection almost. But even an essay collection needs to be linked between everything that we're trying to say thematically. And even an essay collection needs an arc of what the character is trying to do. And I just felt like we're really scratching the surface on what the potential of this could be. And the letters, I mean, I almost think we just need like lines of a letter. I don't think we need to copy and paste letters. I think we build out the narrative arc of what the story is going to be. And then through the letters, like you would any research project, you'd find out what quotes from the letters support the narrative that you're trying to build. And then you know, include those as resources and quotes to build on through the narrative that you're trying to tell. That's how I would use the letters personally, or recommend the letters to be used. This just feels like this person sent us three ideas of a beginning. So it didn't really feel like there was a commitment to a beginning. And again, it makes it feel experimental. And it could just be because this is an, you know, educational platform, they want to know what we think about which of these three could be the best opening potentially, you know. But I think Cece and I both illustrated that in order to achieve that ideal opening, we need a full narrative experience here that these pages just aren't servicing yet.
Thank you so much to Carly and Cece. One of the things that I love most about this podcast is we will say X, Y, and Z, and suddenly a literary agent who's listening to this will decide that this is the book for them, immediately reach out, ask for the author's details, and then everyone's off to the races. So remember, what we say is very subjective, even though we are trying really hard to sort of nudge you in the right direction. So if there are any experimental agents out there who love this, give us a call. Okay, everybody, next week we're back with another author interview. And 2 weeks after that, we're back to Books with Hooks. If you'd like to submit your work, you can go onto the Shit About Writing, go to the Books with Hooks tab, and you can submit it there. Thanks, Carly and Cece. Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, then chances are you've heard me talk about the importance of writing on a line level. And of course I have. Because while movies get to rely on lighting, soundtrack, acting, and special effects, books rely only on words to make a story come to life, which is why the writing matters so much. My question to you is, are you confident about your writing? Do you feel like it's at the level it needs to be to stand out in the competitive publishing landscape? If you're like most writers I know, then you're always looking for ways to improve. Well, what if I told you that there's a way to supercharge your learning experience by hacking writing on a line level? That's right, hacking it. I've developed an original 4-day course, Hacking Writing on a Line Level, that will show you specific techniques to elevate your writing on a word level, sentence level, paragraph level, and scene level. This course begins on December 4th. My favorite part about it is that there are clear, specific examples in every single slide. No fluff, all actionable content. And for the first time ever, we'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. I'm super excited about this new format because I've seen it yield results in writers' works. And it works for writers of any genre, as long as you're serious about improving your writing on a line level and as long as you're a reader. So if you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for this 4-day course. It's a fan favorite. Don't worry if you can't attend live. The sessions will be recorded. For more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast's website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.